Inside Ford and GM, meanwhile, the biggest profits are made not by the manufacturing segment, but by the two financial arms, Ford Credit and General Motors Acceptance Corporation, GMAC. Both are giants in the accounts receivable world. At Ford, the nuts and bolts automotive sector made $850 million before taxes in 2004, while Ford Credit racked up a record pre-tax profit of nearly $5 billion. Both companies' credit subsidiaries, it must be added, go beyond auto loans to services ranging from leases to mortgages and money market instruments. The new bottom line, one could argue, is that manufacturing results have given way. Actual production of goods has become the showroom for a loan origination business. In 1986, Salomon Brothers forecast exactly this kind of era in which credit operations would be the lucrative side of the business. Without that financial backstop, the two firms might have become historical artifacts by the end of the 20th century. The irony is that during the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, the automaking Big Three worked to push the U.S. transportation system into car dependence. Led by GM, the automakers acquired bus manufacturers and lines, then promoted diesel buses to displace both intercity rail transportation and electric transit systems. GM also acquired railroad engine manufacturers, converting their production from electric trains, the norm in 1935, to trains that by 1970 were almost wholly diesel-run. According to Foes, while GM made some money from diesel buses and railroad engines, the larger purpose was to channel the public toward car purchases, where the huge profits lay. Critics often exaggerate, but this case seems broadly supportable. In recent years, ironically, the sales of small and cheaper cars in the United States, once the preoccupation of Henry Ford's Model T culture and GM's early Chevrolet marketing, has slipped into foreign hands. Late in 2003, Toyota passed Chrysler in overall monthly sales, and the GM-Ford-Chrysler market share of all U.S. vehicle sales dropped to under 60%. The overall U.S. market share of GM alone dropped to under 30% from more than twice that in 1970. Of the compact and mid-size cars sold in 2003, 45% and 39%, respectively, were imports, principally Japanese. Limited intercity rail and urban mass transit facilities mean that little of the automobile demand can be diverted that way. Vulnerable automakers have spent much of the last three decades dodging potentially fatal bullets. In the late 1970s and 1980s, Chrysler was bailed out by a federal loan, while Ford was kept afloat by the deep pockets of its founding family. In the 1990s, SUVs mounted the rescue, and in the 2000s, the job was achieved by lucrative financial units, despite costly rebates and interest-free loans to keep the public buying. Whether the automakers will exist a decade or two hence may matter less than the nature of the forces that will chop them down or repackage their surviving parts. The financial side certainly has hazards, in that both GM and Ford borrowed huge sums in the low-interest bond market in recent years to plug holes in their pension funds and fund the costs of their vital incentive plans. Skeptics pictured a pyramid of credit risk, vulnerable to an interest rate crunch that could leave the car companies shut out of unsecured borrowing. On the manufacturing front, both companies might have gone under had they not found the SUV loophole in the mid-1980s. As Japanese manufacturers figuratively ate Detroit's lunch, Ford and GM survived by shifting ever more of their production into SUVs and other light trucks that were, one, exempt from the U.S. fuel efficiency standards applied to automobiles, and two, profitable to a critical degree, even though such vehicles were so heavy in carbon dioxide emissions as to have a limited market in other countries. Through these choices, the automobile companies have painted themselves into a strategic corner. In 2003, the Washington-based World Resources Institute published a survey in which chart after chart showed the manufacturers that are rooted in the U.S. market, Ford, GM, and Daimler Chrysler, turning out most of their sales volume in SUVs and heavy cars and scoring worst in carbon dioxide emissions. The Institute's ultimate measurement, the carbon intensity of each automaker's profits, showed that Ford and GM derive more than three-quarters of their profits from high-carbon-emitting vehicles because their profits are disproportionately attributable to light truck sales. To a considerable extent, the U.S. automobile company's tight corner is also America's. More than most other industries, the surviving U.S.-owned manufacturers are vulnerable to negative economic and energy changes. Should oil and gasoline prices further implode the U.S. domestic SUV and large car market, imperiling domestic manufacturers, ever more of the smaller cars Americans drive will be foreign-made, worsening a U.S. global trade imbalance already inflamed by the surging cost of oil imports. The nation's once proud auto culture could turn into yet another framework for escalating U.S. global indebtedness. The 2006 to 2008 politics looks to be confrontational. Unless the Bush administration can submerge the problems facing U.S. automobile manufacturers, motorists, and daily commuters in some new and successful foreign diversion, U.S. mismanagement in Iraq having only aggravated the oil supply and terrorist threats, the political dependence of the Republican National Coalition on automobiles, gasoline, and drivers stands to be a battleground. During the first George W. Bush administration, that reliance dictated an attempt to turn the Persian Gulf into an American filling station so as to maintain high energy consumption. During the second, disillusioned constituencies became visibly at risk.